We have a legend with us today. Larry Wall is the creator of Pearl, the benevolent dictator for life at the Pearl Project.
I don't want to be a legend yet.
Oh, too early, huh? Yeah, too young to be a legend.
Yeah, I'm only 61.
I'm sorry to say, Mr. Wall, you are a legend. Yeah. And it's not a bad thing. It's really not a bad thing.
I live about a quarter mile from the History Museum, the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, and I try to stay out of there.
Yeah.
I don't want to be history
yet. You don't want to be history yet. Yeah, they'll stuff you and put you up on the on the wall there. Pearl 6 coming out. Actually, it's in beta already. Mm-hmm. And that's big news because it's been, dare I say, 15 years in the making. That's longer than the original Pearl, I would imagine.
Well, it depends on how you count. But yeah.
Yeah. we'll get to Pearl 6. I want to talk a little bit about you, too, though. We have, as I mentioned before we began the show, a broad variety of viewers, some who are expert Pearl users, and they'll have the expert questions for you, not me. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of us are also very interested in you and in when. So tell me a little bit about your start. Were you a computer science major in college?
No, I actually started off majoring in a double major in chemistry and music.
Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect.
Majored in a few other things in the middle. I'm one of these people who stretched 4 years into eight.
Yeah. Well, we're from that great generation that brought us so much innovation. But
I was fortunate to go to a college that let me.
That's nice.
Let me kind of figure my. I was a late bloomer.
So. Do you remember your first personal computer? Well, of course you do. Everybody does.
Well, my first personal computer was actually an Amiga because all the computers I had before that were at work.
Big ones.
And they were. Well, PDP-11, if you count that as big.
Yeah.
Vaxes and such. They were always much more powerful than you could get on the desk. So, we waited until our kids came along and they needed something. So we got an Amiga 1000.
Amiga, yeah.
I still have it.
Do you?
Yeah.
You ever boot it up?
I haven't for a few years.
Yeah. We have one. I think the one we have is it a 4000? We have one in the basement. Yeah. We trot it out every once in a while. We had it up here on Saturday. We were interviewing the guy. A guy who's still selling floppy disks. And so we brought everything up in the basement that still supported floppy disks, including an Osborne 1, an Amiga.
There's a bunch of those in the Computer History Museum.
Yeah, too. Yeah. I have one of my own downstairs. Unfortunately, it's my history. So when you got, did you stay in music and chemistry, or did you get interested in computers at some point?
I got interested in classical Greek, Koine Greek. For a while, I was pre-med major, but probably not because I really wanted to be a doctor. I just wanted to take a whole bunch of different sciences.
Yeah, see, that's
not
what
just,
I did.
Not just chemistry. I got
tired.
I was
a Chinese major. I was interested in stuff, right?
Yeah,
it wasn't
I've always had the problem of being interested in too many things. And but eventually, while I was stretching out my college career, I was working full-time and taking one course a quarter and met my wife, and we got both interested in linguistics.
I love linguistics.
We're planning to be field linguists in Africa. And so we were studying with a professional linguistic organization that also works with a missionary organization. We were going to go out and be Bible translators. So I learned a lot about languages. I had to create my own major, however, because the linguistics major at our college required two foreign languages. So I had all the basic courses and one language, which was Greek, and I persuaded them to substitute a smattering of computer languages for the other language requirement. And my major was called Natural and Artificial Languages.
Very
interesting. I thought I was doing it just to get out of school. It turned out to be quite a prediction of what my future career was going to be.
Yeah.
I didn't know it at the time, though.
Do linguists consider computer languages kind of languages, human languages?
Most of them don't. They think both the linguists and the computer scientists tend to think of computer languages more as a mathematical sort of construct.
A formal description of a problem and solution.
And I felt it was my specialty to be able to take some of the ideas from how a natural language works and apply them to computer languages.
There are nouns, there are verbs.
Yeah, yes, but not so much on a surface level. People think, well, you could just make English like COBOL, But that's a very surface level of how a human language works. The deeper ways in which we use metaphors and things that are similar to each other, take this and use it as that, and let them kind of interplay in a computer scientist would call it, you know, in a Dwimmy fashion, do what I mean.
Right.
And how do you do that without losing control of what the computer is going to do is an interesting problem.
Well, it makes sense because, after all, the human brain works in a particular way. Language is our particular facility as humans. And if you're going to try to get a computer or a machine to do something, it makes sense that whatever mechanism you use to do that is going to end up being kind of linguistic because that's how we communicate, right?
Certainly. And a lot of people think that the purpose of a computer program is to speak to the computer.
Like a conversation.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just as important, the communication with the other programmers around you and to your future self.
More importantly, yes.
You know, as I say, I always assume that whoever reads your code is an axe murderer with a grudge. And
one of my favorite.
And that might even be you.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes.
6 months from now.
So this was at University of California, Berkeley, as a graduate student.
As a graduate student.
You met Gloria, who is here, by the way.
Well, we actually met up at Seattle Pacific University.
Oh, you met at Seattle Pacific.
Yeah.
She's going, no.
Yeah.
Seattle Pacific. But then you both went to Cal.
Yes, we did. We were both in the linguistics program there and met some really famous linguists. George Lakoff, Charles Fillmore were some of our professors.
Do you still love linguistics? Is that still a...
you can't stop loving linguistics.
Yeah.
The way it often comes out, though, is my wife complains that anything she says to me, if there's any ambiguity in it whatsoever, I will misinterpret it intentionally.
Oh, thank goodness for the holes. That's really...
Well,
but that's what's interesting.
That's actually what takes it. It takes that to be a good language designer because a lot of people think they're good language designers, but they don't see where the holes are,
right?
Where the ambiguities are and the traps that people will fall into.
And ambiguity, of course, is not what you want when you're instructing it.
Well,
you need to do things.
You don't want unintentional ambiguity,
right?
Or as we say, unintentional genericity, to use a more technical term. And this is actually one of the reasons why we decided to redesign Perl in starting in the year 2000 was there were some places there where it was unintentionally generic, unintentionally ambiguous. So that was part of the process. It's always a learning thing. You're never perfect on it.
Of course not.
And there is no such thing as a perfect language because one of my favorite books is by Umberto Eco. It's called The Search for the Perfect Language. And it's not about computers. It's about all these ancient ideas of how a perfect language should work. You know, is it Hebrew? Is it Latin? Is it some philosophical language that I can make up? You know, is it Lodgeman? Esperanto?
Right.
And there's always trade-offs. The good language designers, it's funny. We all get along quite well with each other. It's our followers that tend to get into fights because we all understand that how many trade-offs we made,
right?
And which trade-offs we made. So, ambiguity. What we've discovered, a lot of the problem is assuming that you can parse a piece of program and then go back and reparse it as some other language, you know, in retrospect, you know,
right?
In reverse, and that is how usually you end up with accidentally being in more than one language.
Right. I've heard it said that the language really conditions what you think you can do and what you can do.
Yeah, you can either have a strong or a weak Sapir-Whorf hypothesis.
Right.
I'd buy the weak one, but not the strong one. Languages don't really differ in what you can say; they differ in what they make easy.